Hello, this time on Sit Rep.
Starting today, I can announce this government will begin the biggest sustained increase in defence spending since the end of the Cold War. Yeah. We will deliver our commitment to spend 2.5% of GDP on defence, but we will bring it forward so that we reach that level in 2027.
It's billions of extra pounds for the armed forces, and much sooner than pretty much anyone expected. Getting the money is a huge step for defence, but cash doesn't just turn into military capability. So what could it be spent on to strengthen our forces for the future? And what should it be spent on to protect us right now in perilous times for Europe? We'll hear direct from one of the ministers who'll be involved in those decisions and get expert insight from a former MOD insider.
Sit Rep
with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
So, before we dive in, I just want to clear up the numbers questions that have surrounded this announcement. The figure Sir Keir Starmer gave was an extra £13.4 billion of defence spending every year from 2027. That's £13.4 billion more than today, but we did already know some of that money was on the way. However, about £6 billion of that figure is new money for the defence budget. So, Mike, having set out that context, this still looks like a pretty big deal.
Yes. I mean, even though some of it is anticipated, essentially every 0.1 increase in GDP proportion, so going from 2.3 to 2.5 is 0.2%, and every 0.1% is worth about £2.5 to £3 billion. And so what that means is, in cash terms, our defence budget this current year is about £64.4 billion. Next year it goes to about £67.6 billion. And then the year after, it will jump to just over £80 billion. So that's where the benefit will be felt. And that's a pretty significant jump. And the most important thing is that MOD can now plan on that. The government won't change its mind. This is built in, and it's probably the first instalment on even bigger rises in the future, but we'll see. But at least the MOD now knows what it will have to spend for the foreseeable future.
So the goalposts there. And once again with us is Matthew Saville, Director of Military Sciences at the Royal United Services Institute. Hi, Matthew.
Good morning.
Before that, Matthew worked at Defence Intelligence and developed policy and strategy in the Ministry of Defence. So, Matthew, you know well how things work there. How is this announcement going to be going down at the MOD?
Well, I think they'll be pleased to have some extra money. But what will be happening now is the behind-the-scenes wrangling with the Treasury over exactly how much it is and whether there are any conditions attached to this, and critically for them, when this kicks in. So looking back at the kind of the defence budget over the past couple of years, there have been gaps identified, or rather shortfalls, by the National Audit Office in the equipment programme, which amounted to several billion pounds a year. And when we last heard those details, that was equivalent to roughly £7 billion over the financial year that's just ending and the year that's coming up. It was 6.9. But the MOD hasn't produced an equipment plan in 2 years. Mm. And so we don't know what the actual current state of the deficit is. So I think there are a couple of questions about both the genuine scale of the increase over the next few years, but also whether they actually have gaps in funding, you know, a deficit to plug right now.
And the big questions we want to address today: how much could this money increase our military capability? How do you actually make that happen? And how long will it take? And of course, all that depends on how you spend the money. So just some brief food for thought for Mike and Matthew. We asked former Conservative Defence Secretary Sir Gavin Williamson and former Army officer turned Lib Dem MP Mike Martin for their priorities for spending a bigger budget.
We have to see an expansion in what our armed forces are capable of doing in terms of equipment, but also in terms of personnel. Not just our army, but our navy and our air force. It's not something you can do overnight. It takes many, many years to do so.
In terms of the size of the army then, in your opinion, how big should it be?
It should be a minimum of 100,000, and it will take a considerable while to grow it to that number, but we have to be looking at how we reach that target. We see an expansion in terms of not just for regular army, but also in terms of reserve forces. We've got to be looking at how that is properly equipped to an increasingly different type of warfare.
Many of your listeners and viewers will know that the military, the UK military, is really stripped back at the moment. And over the last 5 years, we've just been cutting the amount of training that people have been able to do. We've been giving lots of equipment and munitions to Ukraine, which is absolutely the right thing to do. But actually, I think that 5 billion is not going to give us an increase in capability. It's actually just going to fill in the gaps that your listeners can see all around them when they go to work.
So what kind of gaps do you think it will fill in?
Well, you know, there's an opportunity to start doing more training, more deployments, more operations. It's a chance to restock some of those munitions stockpiles that we've given, you know, rightly to Ukraine. And it's a chance perhaps to refill some of the capabilities like the artillery. I mean, we gave all of our AS-90 to Ukraine, which was the right thing to do. But we've replaced it with only 14, so 155 artillery systems. And we need to start thinking about getting some of those capabilities back into our inventories.
So the wish lists are big: more people, more equipment, more training. But there's no point having people without the equipment they need. There's no point having equipment when there aren't enough people to use it. And there's no point having people who are fully equipped but not trained. Mike, is this just going to be a rebalancing act or growth of the forces?
Well, certainly some of this money, I'm fairly certain, will go into a certain sort of growth. So the enablers, I mean, I'm fairly certain that some of this cash will go into the digitization of the battlefront campaign. It'll go into ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, those sort of things. All the technologies that create this kill web, which makes it more efficient. And some of it, I think, will go into long-range weapons. I don't think we'll see a lot more heavy metal on the front line as a result of this. I don't think we'll see a big increase in numbers of ships, tanks and planes. But we will see, one would hope, the beginning of a step change in all of the transformational technologies. Now, how far they can go down that line with this money is going to be an open question, but I'm fairly certain that that will be the initial priority when, though, as Matthew says, they will have some other gaps to fill more immediately, but the priority in terms of growth will be, let's say, in the electronic spectrum, if we can just put it that way.
What do you think then, Matthew? Is it a rebalancing act or growth of the forces?
I mean, I think there's a little bit of both, but probably more rebalancing. I mean, I would say that a big part of that, it depends on how much of the MOD actually has of this to spend, which might sound odd, and this is going to sound like I'm disagreeing with Michael, but it's worth differentiating between the defence budget, i.e. the money that goes to the MOD and that it spends on equipment and personnel and infrastructure, defence spending, which includes the cost of operations, and so the £3 billion a year that goes to Ukraine is included in defence spending, and then defence spending that is declared to NATO, which has a set of criteria which can include things like some of the activities of the intelligence agencies and that the Prime Minister said would be expanding here. So they're talking about 2.5, or including intelligence, 2.6%. Lots of that the MOD won't have much discretion to spend on. And, you know, a great example is the figure that I'm using for the budget that was planned for next year is actually just over 59 billion. Last year, it was 56.9 billion. The figure that NATO are using for last year is over 64 billion. So there's quite a big gap in what is declared for the percentage target for NATO and what the MOD actually has freedom to spend. So so that's a little bit of sort of a diversion into the oddness of international financial maths. I do think there is a lot that the MOD needs to do to rebuild its foundations. So that is personnel pay, you know, pensions and conditions, accommodation, infrastructure. The big one right now that matters for the next few years is fundamentally every calculation that is done in public or in private on our war stocks says spares and ammunition would be expended very rapidly if we entered into any kind of conflict that looked even remotely like the intensity of Ukraine. We talk about not only has the army given up its self-propelled guns and only brought a few in, but its previous stockpiles of ammunition would have been expended in a week or two. And that might be being generous. And the same is actually true for some of our, you know, what's called complex weapons, air-launched cruise missiles, air-to-ground missiles, all of those sorts of things. And that is vital for actual credible deterrence. People have got to believe that you can fight and do them damage and keep going. And if they think you will be expended in a couple of weeks, your credibility is not great.
Let's talk about the people who feel the difference, the people in the armed forces. The Defence Secretary has said his first task is to arrest the long-term fall in numbers of service personnel and reverse the crisis in recruitment and retention. You could read that as his priority being increased manpower. But having the cash is one thing, but it doesn't solve all the problems of getting and then keeping enough people, does it, Mike?
No, I mean, those, as Matthew said, we've got deeper problems in the offer that is made to serving personnel and all the backup for that. I mean, you know, the MOD has been making some progress in that, but every time they make some progress, they hit with some awful headlines about the treatment of women in the forces or the accusations against what special forces were doing in Afghanistan, some of them. They never seem to really get ahead in terms of public perceptions. But in a way, I think the international situation is now hitting everybody. I mean, everyone is now aware, or more aware than they were even a year ago, of how dark the international situation is. And I suspect that the public may respond to that in a way that may be helpful to the MOD. But they've still got to get the offer right. They've still got to really transform the policy for people that they always talk about, but they've never really been able to make a real contribution to in the last 20 odd years.
Transforming the policy. Matthew, we heard Gavin Williamson talking about an army of 100,000 people. What's the fastest that the army could be grown to that number?
So I honestly don't know. I mean, you could grow very rapidly if you're prepared to pump a huge amount into recruitment, but also training. I mean, this is a big issue that all of the forces have looked at, which is it's all very well to have lots of people applying. And actually what they will tell you is that people who are applying to join the forces are up, but the recruitment and the training pipelines don't have the capacity to actually bring them in. And they lose people either because it takes too long to process them, or if you do join, in certain cases, specialists are having to wait years before they really get into their trade. So the RAF has a particular problem with pilots, not just fast jets, but of all kinds. Actually, this is an area where, again, the forces could and should be looking at their reserves, people who bring particular skills to the forces who might not be needed all the time, but who could be mobilized for specific problems or in areas where it's just not economically viable for the military to run a full-time program of recruitment and training for what might be handfuls of people, but where they absolutely exist in the private sector. And there have been several attempts at reform of how the reserves work over the years. And I think they are, you know, they're looking at it again. We had Al Khans, who's the Minister for Veterans and People at RUSI before Christmas, again, talking about the need for additional resilience through the use of reserve forces.
You really do, Mike, get this sense at the moment that the urgency to do something is really sinking in with the geopolitical and the political situation. There is this immediate need for us to be more capable in our own defence and that of our allies. How do you spend this money, though, wisely to deliver swift results for that?
Well, that's what some of the Defence Review people have been talking about as they embarked on the whole thing. And George Robertson, you know, leading the external part of the review, spoke publicly about the need for sequencing. It's no good just, as Matthew will know, just throwing money at something. You've got to sequence it carefully and think through. And that's where you need the the certainty that you will have an amount of money going forward, and that, you know, as Matthew says, arguments with the Treasury will be quite important. But when the MOD knows what it can spend year by year by year, then it can sequence the spending so that it does it carefully, and then it's got to prioritise, you know, what comes first. Is it the ammunition stocks? Is it the personnel issues? Is it the transformational forces or the transformational enablers? And in reality, you're going to end up doing a bit of all of those things, but you're probably going to have to sequence them so that you spend heavily on one of those areas early and then others a bit later on. And the reserves issue is really important because, you know, we're not going to have an army of 100,000 or 120,000, but we can conceivably have an army of 70-something thousand and a reserve force of 50 or 60 or 70,000 people, which then actually can be the basis of the sort of citizen forces that military leaders have talked about. You know, we're not a country which will have a big army, but in building resilience and building flexibility, there is a lot to be said for putting a big effort into making reserve forces genuinely usable in the way they do in Scandinavian countries.
Really interesting. Matthew, in terms of the balancing act, how much of the money should be about delivering rapid capability and how much should it be about shoring up the long term? How do you get that balance right?
I mean, that's really difficult. A lot of it depends on the process of what the military would call force design, which is they run scenarios to look at actually how the armed forces would perform in a variety of different types of conflict, and they draw conclusions on that over what they need. And the big challenge that they will have is there is a lot of long-term work already in train. You know, there's a shipbuilding program. There is a plan to buy more F-35s. There are, you know, is there aircraft procurement in train, and they will need to work out, do we still need all of that? And the answer is probably yes, and that is all factored in. The big challenge is, if we had to fight in the next couple of years, if we have an unfavorable outcome in Ukraine, and you assume there is an increased threat from Russia in a few years as it reconstitutes, what does that look like? I mean, I think the focus should be on improving the deployability of the forces that we currently have. And that means, you know, the greater emphasis now on stopping the outflow of people. We're losing more people than we're recruiting each year by several thousand, and stockpiles and infrastructure and ammunition. In some cases, you can make early inroads into that. In some cases, you've got to place the orders now to get weapons 2 or 3 years down the line.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be the priority. I think there is an interesting challenge for the army, which is that the Chief of the General Staff has set then the target of doubling their combat output within 3 years. He did that a year ago. I think they will be the ones who are looking at, is there stuff off the shelf that we could buy? And they will be looking at more sensors, electronic warfare equipment, and how do they improve their firepower with a very small armoured force, tanks, with a very light artillery force, you know, that small number of archers, there's a replacement on the way, and some, you know, guided multiple launch rocket systems. So they are the candidates who are looking at, where can we bring in drones to complement, not replace, artillery of different kinds? Can we bring in deeper strike weapons? But what can we get that is already available, or adapt what is already available? So I think the balance in many cases should be on foundational work. I think there are some areas, particularly in the army, where they might be looking at where can they bring in some new capability now.
So if I can put this question to both of you, put your cards on the table. What do you think the money will be spent on? Mike, to you first.
I think it'll be spent on making good some of the greatest deficiencies, because they've got to be addressed. So, and that will take up a certain amount of it. And then, as I say, I believe that some of it will go on these transformational technologies, and the public won't see very much of them until we need them. So those would be my first two bets, as it were. First of all, on things like personnel and ammunition stock sustainment, and that will be a longer term program. But then second priority will be these transformational developments, which are not so expensive, but you do have to invest in them, and you do need new partnerships with industry. I mean, one of the things I'm sure the government will want to do is not just renew the partnership with industry, but change the basis of it, because it hasn't been very good for the last 20 or 30 years, to be honest.
Matthew?
Where it will and where it should be spent are actually quite difficult to answer, because the MOD's recent history is that it tends to have eyes bigger than its stomach, or at least its budget. I would hope that there would be a focus on people and infrastructure, and then accelerating some of the weapons stockpiles. And then I think there will be a proportion that goes towards what Michael called the sort of the transformational stuff, where it is available in the near term. I mean, fundamentally, that needs to happen. Otherwise, the army can't meet that ambitious target. And I would just add, in the background, there is the behemoth that is the nuclear enterprise that is eating money at a ferocious rate. And that is notionally ring-fenced in the defence budget, as in it's protected against other pressures. But it looks, given the way that the deterrent submarine patrols keep being extended to increasing lengths, like they are holding on to the continuous at-sea deterrent by their fingertips. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a little bit that needs to be directed towards that if it continues to ferociously eat up money.
Well, as yet, the government hasn't said how it plans to spend the money, but we have had some sense of their broad thinking. I mentioned the Defence Secretary's focus on arresting the long-term fall in numbers, and the Defence Veterans and People Minister, Al Carnes, has been telling SITREP's Sian Gresecek-Melbourne what he thinks this money can deliver.
Importantly, it deters our adversaries, it demonstrates leadership to our allies, and it will give the right type of equipment and the financial bracket to deliver resources back to defence to prepare them for not just war in the immediate future, but war in the long term as well.
So you're mentioning equipment there. Can you tell us precisely what this money is going to be spent on then?
You know as well as I do, Sian, there's a strategic defence review ongoing. That strategic defence review will really clearly work out how we're going to fight, what we need to fight it, and then the investment opportunities that we need to make sure our armed forces are equipped to fight the next war. Taking a lot of those lessons from Ukraine in particular to ensure that we act upon those lessons and equip our armed forces correctly.
So we're going to have to wait till the spring on the detail.
You know as well as I do, of course we're going to have to wait till the spring. There's no point going off half-cocked and giving early announcements that aren't inculcated into a much broader and more well-thought-through plan, which the Strategic Defence Review will deliver.
Well, without those specifics, can you talk more broadly, though, in terms of letting personnel know? Do you want to see more personnel? And if you do want more, how are you going to do that? And how long will it take, given the difficulties that you're currently...
Sean, you know as well as I do, we're not going to get drawn into the specifics of the Strategic Defence Review. That will come out in due course. What I would say is that spending on defence will absolutely be an engine for growth. And that's not just based on capability, such as missile systems, jets, planes and boats, what we'd usually think. But it's also some of the more, what I would see, far more important issues, such as people basing infrastructure and ensuring that we have a comprehensive review that looks at all the different aspects of both service life and our ability to fight, which is really, really important.
You've got over a huge hurdle to get the money, but how challenging is it to spend that money to meaningfully improve our defence capability? And how long will it take to see greater capability?
Well, we know we've got a couple of big programmes on running. We've got the Strategic Defence Review, which I mentioned already. We've also got Defence Reform, which is looking at really starting to get through some of the bureaucracy within defence and make decisions and spending on relevant capability easier, specifically with the National Armaments Director in due course. So I think we've actually got a combination of different programmes that are going to join up in the near future, which will allow us to really take a holistic look on how we fight, what we need to fight, and the investment choices we need to make. And that will be a much better, it may take a bit longer, but it'll be a much better, well thought through plan than jumping to immediate decisions on a whim.
Well, the government's line has long been that the defence review would be ready in the spring. Privately, we've been hearing that it was, if not complete, then almost there, but the spending announcement gives them new information, doesn't it? And perhaps more importantly, there are the shockwaves from the many diplomatic bombshells dropped by Washington in the last couple of weeks. Mike, if it was as good as finished, would it still be valid, or has the context changed so much now that significant rewriting is actually needed?
Probably not, because the review is meant to set the terms for British defence for quite a long time, not till the next review in 5 years' time or whatever it might be. It is intended to address a new strategic reality. Now, of course, part of that strategic reality may be that the United States is no longer committed to European security in the way that we always assumed, but that doesn't change the basic terms of reference as to what is in Britain's interests. So it may be that it is still in Britain's interest to stay as close to the United States as possible, even if you can't get as close as you used to be able to get. So I don't think the present turmoil in the Western Alliance will affect the writing too much, but it may affect the way in which the review, when it appears, is subsequently implemented. But I don't think it affects the basic assumptions about what is in Britain's long-term strategic interests.
And we're promised a national security strategy before the NATO summit. When we look at the fact this extra money for defence is all being taken away from the international aid budget, that's not money we simply spent out of the goodness of our own hearts, is it? It's always come with the self-interest of aiming to reduce conflict. Matthew, how much difference will that make to conflict risk?
A lot of that depends on your views on the effectiveness of the spending of international development assistance. I mean, I think it could be quite serious, because it's a fairly large hit on what is left of the international development and aid budget. The government says that it has found a lot of efficiency that could be pulled out of the system, because it thinks some of that money, well, I mean, some of the money has been going to effectively supporting people in the UK, fundamentally, as sort of asylum seekers. But it's a pretty hefty chunk. And there's a sense to which this is all a little bit backwards, which is that doing the national security strategy after you've done the defence review and after you have a whole range of other reviews across government, like our, you know, China audit, is a bit cart before horse, frankly. I mean, there was a feeling that the reason why they did a defence review rather than a full NSS was that they regarded the conclusions of the integrated review that was done in 2020 and 2021 and the refresh of that as still sound, i.e. that described the UK's approach to national security and the world effectively, and that what was needed was a real rummage through the guts of defence to fix some of the problems there. So whilst it's always welcome to have a kind of reset of national security strategy, it is a little bit backwards.
And what do you think, Mike? Was it worth the trade, international aid for defence?
I think it was one of those things that one suspects that the Treasury drove it. They said, look, if you want, you know, effectively 6 billion more cash for defence, you must take it from somewhere else. And it has to be 6 billion's worth. And if you look at new cash, if you look at what came out of the aid budget, which is 13 billion, 40% of it is being reduced, is being transferred. So 40% of 13 billion is about 6 billion, just about right. And as Matthew said, I mean, what it leaves a budget of 0.3% of our GDP, and only about half of that is spent on aid. The other half is spent on things like hotels for asylum seekers and goes to domestic charities and so on. And so there's a good case, there's always been a good case for having a good look at the way we spend the aid budget and whether we're really spending it in a way that benefits the soft power that Britain wants to generate around the world. But I must admit, there was a sort of sense of political expediency in saying we are reducing foreign aid and we're putting that money from foreign aid into defence. And if that doesn't impress the Americans, nothing will.
Yes. If we go even bigger picture, the Prime Minister talked about a generational response, changing our national security posture that will need a whole society effort that will reach into the lives, the industries and the homes of the British people. I mean, Mike, you kind of touched on it before. Can you expand a bit more on what that means?
Yeah, I thought it was very clear in the Prime Minister's statement to the Commons when he harked back to the era of Attlee and Bevin in the 1950s. And I think what the government is about is to say that, you know, we don't any longer have wars of discretion. We can't choose whether to go to Afghanistan or whether to go to Iraq or whether to go to Sierra Leone or whether to go to East Timor or Bosnia. Now war is coming towards us. And we have to rework the whole model, which is not to say that we've got to create a war economy, but we've got to create an economy which regards defence as not just a nice to have extra, but pretty fundamental to all the other things that we want our economy to do and our society to represent. So I think there's a sort of cultural change at play here, which the government is keen to try to push by several means. And I think we'll hear a lot more of that in the next 12 to 18 months.
So I think one of the challenges here is that there is a high level of rhetoric about what you've described as a generous response. And I don't think there has been necessarily a kind of government approach that actually matches that level of urgency. And we can see this in the debate around, we're sort of quibbling over points of a percent to reach 2.5, rather than asking, actually, what is required here? What do we need of our armed forces? What should they do more broadly? And then the kind of national investment that actually creates capacity. And that is true of how we've looked at the issue of reserves. It's how we've looked at the issue of mobilization, how we've looked at defense industry. The government is now going to produce yet another defense industrial strategy. It will need significant investment. Now, if you're the Chancellor, and she has been making this argument this week, what you want to do is link that to the growth agenda. Mm-hmm. I think there's a, what we need is a government messaging campaign that links defence to national security, and that sounds like wordplay, but actually explains why we face a range of threats, but does so in a way that actually doesn't immediately plunge into what you might see as political or the culture wars. I think we have a problem at the moment, which is that Russia and other countries use other forms of influence that are nothing to do with the area that I study, the military, which is economic pressure, information propaganda. And we are now, we've got the situation where some commentators talk about misinformation and disinformation and put it in inverted commas as if it isn't a thing. Mm. That is a problem, because we now have a public debate that is sceptical over a significant proportion of the threat. So I've sort of veered off the question of military issues into the broader issue of national security. I think we need to reground understanding what the threat is and where it is and isn't military.
And something that wasn't entirely helped by the comments made recently by J.D. Vance either. I'm going to give you both a moment to gather your final thoughts. I just want to play a little bit from an extra edition of the SITREP podcast, which is out now. We've been talking to the historian Ian Sanders about whether there are lessons we should apply from the Cold War, when we would typically spend between 4% and 5% of our national income on defence.
At that point, we had the British Army of the Rhine, which was about 55,000 troops stationed in West Germany to deter a Soviet invasion. The RAF was probably double the personnel it was at the moment. And similarly, the Royal Navy. And the Royal Navy had significantly more ships at that point. The role of it is deterrence, is to stop a possible enemy attacking. The last thing, obviously, you want to do is go to war. And the situation we've got into at the moment is that, you know, it's not enough of a deterrence force as we had during the Cold War. We've still got the nuclear deterrent, but that's absolutely going to be the last option.
Matthew, deterrence is ultimately better than fighting. What are our enemies and allies going to be making of Keir Starmer's big announcement on defence this week?
I mean, I think in truth, what they'll be doing is counting what the outputs are. If we can demonstrate a higher level of activity, exercising, operating, working with others, and it looks credible, and they think that we have, you know, a larger stockpile and more national resilience, then that might give some people pause for thought. If it's alongside others, like we shouldn't, I mean, see ourselves in isolation here. Europe as a whole has been spending more on defence over the last 10 years, ever since the NATO summit in Wales in 2014. But what it hasn't done is turn that into, in most cases, larger, more deployable armed forces. The German defence budget is now bigger than ours. The Bundeswehr is smaller than the UK army and has terrible deployability. It's actually been the Poles who have, for example, more substantially increased their army. So a Europe that is able to demonstrate that it has more credible, more deployable forces as a whole will actually look much more like a deterrent threat. And I think in the background, we do have the issue of reliability on the US. And in the short term, there are a number of areas where we are wholly dependent on the US for additional combat power. And the other thing that we and other European countries will need to coordinate on is both where do we pick winners and potentially losers in defence industry to increase our output and reduce duplication, but maintain resilience? Where do we decide that we should specialise? So taken as a whole, the $457 billion that Europe currently spends produces armed forces commensurate with that investment.
And Mike, over the last 15 years or so, you and I have talked so many, many times about defence cuts. When we've talked about more money for defence, it's generally been presented as a one-off boost. Does this long-term commitment to 2.5% and ambition to reach 3% signal a real turning point in our history?
I think it's meant to. I think Keir Starmer has talked about this as a generational challenge. When he became Prime Minister, I wasn't sure that he actually appreciated that issue, or that Downing Street did, or Number 10 did, the staff. I mean, I think the MOD always did, and the analysis community have been talking about it for a long time, where it's a generational point. But I think now the Prime Minister does get it. I think he does mean that it is generational, that he will be judged. Even though he wants to be a Clement Attlee, he wants to be a domestic Prime Minister, I think fate is going to define the fact that he will be known for what he does in the foreign space and maybe the defence space. So the issue is not, does the Prime Minister and Number 10 get it? They do, but now can they deliver? And that will be a much tougher job for him than it was for Clement Attlee.
Mike, Matthew Saville from RUSI, thank you both so much. That is all for now. Professor Michael Clarke and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest defence news on our website, forcesnews.com. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.